And welcome, welcome. This is actually going to be a double shiur. This is one going to be a shiur, a Torah class that we're sharing over the phone with our friends at Park Plaza. Additionally, I'm broadcasting on Facebook Live. Now, I guess I'll start with a little story. Before Pesach, when this whole stay-at-home order was in place, we were sort of new to it, and I was trying to broadcast with a Facebook Live on the Why You Torah Mitzvah and Kolos page, and I accidentally started broadcasting to my own personal Facebook. And as I'm broadcasting, I didn't realize, and I'm seeing all these people that I know in my own personal life, not in my Kola life, and they're all popping on, they're commenting, and so I'm trying to figure out, why are all these people watching? And then I realized, oh my gosh, I'm on the wrong Facebook page. And so after about three and a half minutes, I dropped off on my personal Facebook page and I joined the YU Kolos Facebook page, and this year went as it went. However, I had a bunch of friends who said, what are you doing? I wanted to hear that shiur. That looked so interesting. It looked so fun. And a number of people over the past 2 months have commented on it. So I thought, maybe, why not? We'll broadcast this shiur that's being delivered only over the phone to our friends at Park Plaza. I'll also do it on Facebook Live. So to all my friends on Facebook Live, hello, hello. It is so wonderful to see you, to have you join me. And so what we're going to do today, we're going to learn about the Nazir. Because in Parshat Nasa, the Parsha that we're reading this week, if we're in Chutz La'aretz, if we're in Eretz Yisrael, they already passed Nasa, but stinks to be them because Nasa is a beautiful Parsha. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at the Nazir. We're going to look at it from the perspective of Rav Sham Shimon Fahl Hirsch, one of the leading modern Orthodox perspectives. His commentary on the Torah is fundamental and monumental, incredible. And then we're going to look at it from the perspective of one of my dear Rebbeim, Rabbi Judah Michel. And Rav Judah Michel is today is one of the foremost teachers I won't say foremost teachers. Rav Judah Michel is a Rebbe to many, many people in the world. A lot of people feel very close to him. He's very, very relatable. He's very sincere. He's extraordinary. He's wonderful. And we appreciate him so very much. And we're going to sort of take these two approaches and we're going to combine them at a certain point. And so when we talk about the Nazir really starts with the first pasuk and the first Rashi talking about it. You know, ish ki afli neder. When a person or a man or a woman decides they want to become a Nazir, what happens? What do they need to do? Rashi explains that they make a neder, they swear, I'm going to be a Nazir. But why would anyone become a Nazir? What's motivating a person to decide that they want to become a Nazir? A Nazir who's not going to cut their hair, they're not going to come in contact with a dead body, they're not going to eat any grapes, any wine, no wine-based products. What's motivating that person? Says Rashi, according to the Gemara Masechet Sota, a person sees a sota bikilkula. Rashi says, "Lama nisvacha parshat nazir leparshat sota." Lomar lacha shekol haroa sota bikilkula yazir atzmo min hayayin. That anyone who's going to see this sota, and we're going to explain what the sota is in just a moment. Anyone who sees this isha sota is says, "Wow, I got to stay away from wine. It's not going to work." And then Rashi concludes, says, "Shehu mevil yedei niuf." Because wine clearly leads people to make bad decisions, leads people to adultery or some other form of bad actions. We know that many, many bad decisions have been predicated by consumption of wine. And so, what's so inspiring for this guy about the sota process? Rashi seems to suggest it's not inspiration, per se. It's this sota process is making the guy say, I can't possibly fall into this pitfall. I'm not going to drink and find myself making decisions that I'm not proud of. Instead, I need to become a Nazir. I'm going to abstain from wine. I'm going to be removed so that I don't make this mistake. So in order to understand what's really motivating the Nazir, we got to look at the Sota process. What's happening with the Sota? The Sota is a very, very unfortunate story. It's really the story of a broken marriage. A Sota is a woman who was suspected by her husband of cheating. And the husband warns the woman, says, please, please, please. Actually, maybe not please. Maybe he says, wife, I'm warning you. Do not go into private with this man. I don't trust you. I don't trust him. I don't think that this is a kosher environment. And so I don't think you should continue doing it. Okay, fine. This woman doesn't seem to take the hint, doesn't seem to appreciate that her husband is feeling insecure. And she nonetheless goes into private with another man. And there are witnesses. And now this woman is called an Isha Sota. and she's forbidden to her husband, and the only way for them to get back together is to go to the Kohen at the base of Mikdash. And so the process, they go to the Kohen at the base of Mikdash, and the Kohen leads her through a very, very elaborate procedure where she's carrying things and her clothing is torn and she looks disheveled and terrible. It's a degrading process, which is why Rashi and the Gemara say, someone who sees the Sota, not the Isha Sota that she's not allowed to be with her husband, not the Isha Sota who's cheating with somebody else, the Isha Sota Bikil Kula, in her degradation. That person who sees her in her degradation, that person is going to say, I got to stay away from this because I got to stay from away from wine. Yeah, just by the way, for anyone who's maybe feeling a little nervous, I've yelled at my wife before, my husband's yelled at me before. Gemara tells us that a sota, it doesn't really happen these days. It highly discourages anyone from making an explicit warning in front of witnesses. It's very rare that we yell at our spouses in front of witnesses, and it's okay for spouses to fight, but definitely better to do it in private than in public, and to God willing, make up afterward. But also, Gemara in Masechet Sota suggests that any woman who goes through the Sota process, her husband's also going through a process as well. It's a two-part procedure of this general marriage. And so they go to the Kohen, and maybe this is sort of the source of the Kohen being, or of a rabbi being the source that people go to, the address whenever there's a marital dispute. And it's an elaborate and exhausting and difficult and degrading procedure. So this guy sees this procedure going on and says, wow, that's terrible. I got to stop drinking wine. I'm swearing off of wine because I don't want that to happen to me. So seemingly, it makes sense. Rashi's saying the sota is a terrible procedure. It's a terrible situation, terrible circumstance. And this guy doesn't want that to happen to him, and so he's going to stop drinking wine. That might explain one of the laws of sota, of nazir. The Nazir stopped drinking wine. But according to that approach that Rashi is seemingly suggesting, both in the Gemara and in his commentary on Chumash, why does the Nazir stop cutting his hair? Why does the Nazir stop coming in contact with a dead body? What's motivating this person? In what way or form is that helping the person avoid adultery? I guess, if you don't look so good, then you're not likely to end up committing adultery. Maybe that's the reason why so many people sort of let themselves go after marriage. But I don't think that's necessarily a good enough reason. Not cutting your hair to avoid adultery doesn't seem to fit. No contact with dead bodies seemingly definitely doesn't fit into the approach and the goal of I don't want to end up cheating on my spouse. So maybe this abstention from going to barbershops, which some of us have experienced lately, is actually something else. And I guess first we'll suggest the approach of Rav Judah Michel, and then we'll look at Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch's, I think, is a little bit more normative, but I think Rav Judah Michel really, he paints the picture for us. He helps us appreciate and understand what's really going on in the Sota process. Because you never know this unless you don't trust Rashi. There's a story that Rav Bina, my Rosh Yeshiva, likes to tell, that when he started in yeshiva, his father told him that Rava and Abaye, the two most prominent rabbis found in the Talmud, he says, you got to assume that they're card-dealing tricksters. Now, not to say that they're actually criminals, not that they're to say that Rava and Abaye are not actually honorable people, but that Rava and Abaye should never be trusted unless you can understand what's motivating them. You can't just say, oh, well, Rava says this, that must be the answer. Abaye suggests this, that must be the right move. You've got to personally understand what's motivating them, why they're saying this, why they're doing it. And actually, yesterday, there was a memorial for Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, and I was watching it earlier today, and his son-in-law, Rabbi Drach, said that when he was learning as a young kid, when Rabbi Lamb was learning how to become a rabbi, learning how to become a Talmud Chacham, learning how to be a Jew, he once saw Tosfot quote a Rashi in a different Gemara, and he started, just goes, okay, that's what Rashi says, fine, he keeps reading, and his father stops him, and he says, you can't just assume that when Tosfot quotes Rashi, that that's authentic, that he's right. Just because a rabbi said something doesn't mean you should believe it. Anytime anyone quotes something in the world of Torah, you cannot trust them. You've got to see it for yourself. Whether the person is as trustworthy as possible, whether it's your rebbe, it's your teacher, it's your rabbi, it's your father. Unless you look it up inside, you can't assume that they're accurate, that that's the true way to express this idea. And so when it comes to Torah, just because someone said something doesn't mean that that's good enough. That's not sufficient. And so when Rashi quotes the Gemara Masechet Sota, we have to be a little bit suspicious. Is that exactly what the Gemara said? And so I was fortunate enough that I went to Yeshiva Netiv Aryeh, and I spent the end of my Shana Aleph poring over Masechet Sota. Masechet Sota was the Gemara that we were learning, and I drilled into my mind, and I definitely still can't quote every page, but Baruch Hashem, I feel very comfortable with Masechet Sota. I'm very familiar with it. And if you look at the very beginning of Masechet Sota, where Rashi seemingly is quoting, Masechet Sota doesn't say that the person's going to stop drinking because drinking leads to niyuv, because it leads to adultery. Rashi added in that last part. Rashi is tricking us. So maybe for Rashi, the motivation of becoming a Nazir is because otherwise, and you know, I might end up committing adultery. But the Gemara doesn't seem to think that. Gemara seems to think something entirely different. Now let's try and understand what the Gemara is thinking and how Rav Judah explains and appreciates it. Beforehand, I want to give a little context. You know, the Mishnah in Masechet Avot, in Pirkei Avot, in the fifth chapter of Mishnah 5, talks about 10 miracles that took place on a daily basis in the Beis HaMikdash. Maybe not a daily basis, but on a frequent basis in the Beis HaMikdash. These were very common, almost happenstance. And the Gemara lists all 10 of these, and some of them are more noticeable than others, but you know, just to name a few, there was a pillar of fire that ascended from the Mizbeach all the way up to the heavens. And whether it was raining or whether it was windy, that pillar of fire never moved. It moved. It was constant. And the Beis HaMikdash, there were 10 miracles there every day. It was a place of miracles. This temple was extraordinary. It was quite literally miraculous. It was awe-inspiring. And Rav Judah says that this person shows up at the Beis HaMikdash. They're going to the Beis HaMikdash. And what's happening at the Beis HaMikdash? There are these 10 miracles that took place on a daily basis. And in addition to those miracles that took place on a daily basis, you've got people who are going to be inspired. You've got the Kohanim, who are the priests, who are serving in the Beit HaMikdash. And you've got the Levim, who are serving the Beit HaMikdash. And you have the Kohen Gadol, the holiest person in the Beit HaMikdash, the holiest place. And you've got people who are coming and bringing Korbanot. They're coming to bring a Karban Todah, a thanks offering to Kadosh Baruch Hu, because something wonderful that happened to them. You've got people coming to bring a Karban Olah, because they want to be closer to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. You have people bringing a Karban Chatat, people who are just bringing a Karban because they messed up and they want to make up for it. You've got all these incredible things happening in the Beit HaMikdash. It was such an inspiring place. There was so much good, so much commitment, so much connection happening in the temple. And this guy shows up. And he sees a Sota Bilkilkula. He sees a woman who's going through this Sota process. This woman who was accused of cheating on her husband and going through this elaborate process in the context of the overall Beit HaMikdash. And that's what you notice? That's what you see? If you're familiar with the construction of the temple, basically all the action was happening over here, and right in front of that was a small area where the Jewish men could stand. Women were on the outside of a gate, and there was a gate called the Shar Nicanor. Shar Nicanor is where this process of the Sota took place. And so if a person was approaching the temple, you know, I'm going to see the temple, and in front of me is the pillar of smoke billowing up, the Mizbeach, the Kohanim all over. And there's a gate in front of me, and within that gate, sort of on the side of the gate, there's this Sota process happening. Rav Judah says, you're in the Beis HaMikdash. You're in the holiest place in the entire world. You're looking at the Isha Sota. Right behind her is the Beis HaMikdash. Right behind her is this pillar of cloud that never changes, never moves. You could have been inspired by that, and you're inspired by this woman who's cheating, and that's what's going to bring you close, per se, to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's what's going to make you holy, that you're going to stop drinking. You're going to become a Nazir because you don't want to end up cheating on your spouse. There are so many things in the Beit HaMikdash that could have inspired you, and yet none of these are working. None of these are connecting you. Instead, the only thing that connects you is this Isha Sota. It says, Rav Judah, there's something wrong with you. You've got to do something extreme, something to reevaluate, recalibrate, because you're like a little bit off if you look at the Sota, you look forward, and you see the Sota right behind her with all the inspiration that entails the base of Megdash, and you're inspired, if you will, by the Sota? Yeah, there's something wrong with you. You need to become a Nazir. But let's look at that another way. Because maybe it's not just that, okay, you know, Nikdas Yayin Yatsa Sod. One of our Rebbeim likes to say that, I think Rav Moshe Shapiro likes to say, you know, we say, the Gemara tells us, Nikdas Yayin Yatsa Sod. When wine comes in, the secrets, the inner you comes out. And so Rav Moshe Shapiro says that, you know, unless you're 40 years old, there's probably not much inner you, and that shouldn't really be coming out. Whatever is inside, it doesn't really count. So no one under 40 should drink on Purim. That's not an official psak. That's just what Moshe Shapiro suggests. And for a lot of people, if what's going on inside you is not so great, you don't need to share that with the world. And so fine, I can appreciate if this guy is a little bit off. He doesn't appreciate where he's supposed to get his inspiration. It could come from the base of Mikdash, and yet it's coming from the Sota. It could be positive, and instead it's negative. That person's a little off. We don't want their inner Sod coming out. But maybe there's a little bit more to it, because Rashi seemed to have stated it, that, you know, a person needs to stay away from adultery. But the language of Sota Bikil Kula, explains Rav Judah, doesn't actually have to be a negative. Maybe the language of Sota Bikil Kula, seeing this woman in her degradation, maybe that is the positive. Maybe that is where the inspiration can come from. Because let's think about it. What is a Sota process? What's happening? This woman has been accused of cheating on her husband. And she could very easily just say, forget it, I'm out, I'm getting a divorce. And yet, what does she do? She says, I don't care, I'm going to go to the Beit HaMikdash. I'm going to go to the temple. I'm going to go to this holy place. And I'm going to talk to the rabbi, to the Kohen, about this interaction that I've been having. And it's going to be uncomfortable, and it's going to be weird, but I'm going to do it anyway. And not only that, not only will I have this challenging conversation, but I'm going to go through a degrading process because I'm so committed, so interested in making my marriage work. I'm going to put as much effort as I possibly can in to save this relationship. When the Nazir sees a Sota Bikil Kula, that's not a bad thing. That's a wonderful thing. The fact that this woman's going through all that just to make her marriage work, she could throw it away. There's some other guy who's seemingly interested. And yet she's saying, no, this is important to me. This is what I want. You should look at the Sota and say, oh my gosh, that's incredible. I'm so inspired. Not just that. Think about the whole Sota process. There's only one time that we're allowed to erase God's name. One of the Ten Commandments is do not erase God's name. And yet in the context of the Sota, which we conveniently always read either right before or right after Shavuos, where we read one of the Aseret Dibros that you're not allowed to erase God's name, Parshat Naso comes around, we learn about the Sota, and God says, erase my name. Write out the whole Sota procedure on a special parchment, put it into water, mix it all up, my name will be erased. And then she drinks that water. And if it turns out that she did not cheat, then she'll receive bracha. And if it turns out that she did cheat, then the water that had my erased name in it will reveal that to the world. And this is always fun to share with, you know, the kids, although the kids, you know, of any age, it's cool, exciting and interesting for me also. If in fact she did cheat, and the Gemara comments, and her husband was not faithful as well, if it was both sides of the coin, then her stomach explodes. Now, exactly what does that mean? Okay, that's for another time. But her stomach explodes, it reveals something bad. But this guy's looking at the Isha Sota, and he should say, oh my gosh, God wants his name erased in order to save this marriage? Look at how far HaKadosh Baruch Hu is willing to go to erase his own name so that this marriage can be saved. And, you know, somewhat tangentially, Derek Musser, I guess you could say, frequently there are couples who don't realize that it's better to, quote-unquote, erase God's name, better to not be so frum, and in order to save the relationship, to save the marriage. You know, these days, you know, people aren't going to Minyan anyway, but there are many men who run out of the house for Minyan and for learning and for all the things they need to get done in the house. And maybe they should be spending a little more time at home, a little bit less time learning for this period of time. Now, on the other hand, it's the wife's obligation to be pushing her husband, say, no, you go to Minion, you go learn, you get out of the house, I'll take care of it. And if both parties are saying, no, I want to be home, I want to be supportive, and the other one wife is saying, no, I want you out of the house, I want to support you, then that's beautiful. But very, very frequently, people are so concerned about, I guess, quote-unquote, erasing God's name, that they're shallow and biased, that their relationship with their spouse falls apart. And this is a beautiful example of how important it is to maintain shalom bayit, even if it means that you can't be as quote-unquote connected to God, that you're not going to be able to maintain, make sure that God's name is not erased, if you will. So, we've got this guy who's going to be coming down here. And he's visited the Beis HaMikdash and has so much to look at for inspiration. But his most inspiring thing is not the korban, not the offerings being brought, not the pillar of smoke ascending, not the kohanim and the levim, the music singing God's praises. But this Isha Sota, this woman. And it's fascinating if you think about it. It's kind of a weird thing that we do, that we take this couple that's having marital issues, and not just marital issues, they're not communicating well, but that there's a concern of cheating. Now, cheating is like amongst like the dirtiest things that can happen, that we can do. We think of that as being, you know, base animal nature. Does that conversation belong in the temple, in the holiest place that we have? Why are we bringing this couple who's having marital issues to the temple? Maybe it's because actually the holiest thing you can do, as God tells us by erasing his name, the holiest thing you can do is to save a marriage. And so this guy has a totally messed up perspective, says Rav Judah Michel. Rav Judah teaches us that this guy has to become a Nazir. This guy needs to become separate from the whole world. We say Nazir Miloshon Zar, Nazir meaning that you're a stranger. You're clearly not connected to Am Yisrael. You're disconnected from Am Yisrael. Because you look at this and you can't see the beauty in it. You can't see that there's a couple coming together because of the Sota process. There's something wrong with you. You need a paradigm shift. You need to spend a month as a Nazir, as disconnected and separate, because you're just not getting it. Because you don't get it, you become a Nazir. This guy becomes a Nazir because he's got the wrong perspective. Someone who emphasizes in their mind, so sad that this Isha Sota is degraded, that it's bad, it's unfortunate. This person's a mess. They need to readjust. And that's how Rav Judah explains the Sota leading into the Nazir. That the Nazir really needs to become closer to the Jewish people. And I think that can help us appreciate the statements of Rav Hirsch. Because Rav Hirsch says, let's think about the practices, the halakot, I guess, if you will, of being a Nazir. If you're a Nazir, it means that you don't cut your hair. Why would not cutting your hair help? That's the question we asked earlier. What does that have to do with maybe avoiding adultery, or even if we're following the Rav Judah approach? How does not cutting my hair connect me more to the Jewish people? So Rav Hirsch explains that that hair essentially acts as a barrier. Now, for us, for human beings, you know, we have hair on our head, maybe we have hair on our faces. For those lucky enough, we have hair on our arms and our backs. But generally, hair is a function of, for most creatures in the world, hair or fur protects you. You know, a bear going into the winter is going to grow more hair to get a thicker protection to keep it safe. Hair functions to separate between you and the outside. Hair is a barrier. And so Rav Hirsch explains that growing out hair is an indication that there's a barrier between you and what's going on outside of you. Maybe a barrier between you and a Kodesh Baruch Hu, maybe a barrier between you and the people around you, between the Jewish community, between your community. Because, and like Rav Judah explained, there's clearly a barrier because you're so cornered off, you're so separate from the rest of the people that you can appreciate that this Sota process is beautiful. So the Nazir grows out his or her hair to represent a separation. But does that remind us of any other time, any other spiritual connection? Of growing your hair? When else might somebody grow their hair? A metzora. Someone who has tzarat, someone who has leprosy. When someone has leprosy, someone who's spoken lashon hara, who's gossiped about another person, that person's also disconnected. If you're willing to gossip about someone else, we don't gossip about people that we care about. We gossip about people that we don't care much about. If you're so disconnected from that other person that you're willing to gossip about them and speak lashon hara, then you're going to get tzarat and you're going to have to grow out your hair. as another display, like with the nudger, that you're separate, you're disconnected. There's some blockade between you connecting to this other person. And so we see it with nazir, and we see it with sarat. And so let's take this one step further. I heard from my very good friend, Yoni Steinfeld, that he was trying to understand what it means to love someone else. What does V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha actually look like? You know, it's a song we can sing, we can talk about it, it's, you know, favorite quote, favorite Tzvar Torah, but what does it actually look like? So Rav Noach Weinberg, the founder of Eshet Torah, he says, well, in order to understand what V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha is, why don't we look at the opposite? Instead of trying to understand what it means to love ourselves, let's start with what it looks like when someone, God forbid, hates another person. So what does that look like? What is that ayin ra? What does it look like when someone dislikes someone else? Well, it basically means that you view them poorly, that you see them in a negative light. For example, somebody comes late to a meeting. Someone comes late to some get-together. If you don't like the person, then it's, oh my gosh, what's wrong with her? How could she be so insensitive? She doesn't care about this. This isn't important to her. She has things that she'd rather be doing. How could she be so insensitive? And if we don't like someone, that's generally how we're going to ascribe all their actions, as being motivated by something bad, something nefarious. However, if we like someone, then all of those things somehow go away. Somebody shows up late, oh, there was traffic, and there's a lot of things going on, and you don't understand, and it's really okay. This person, of course, didn't have any bad intentions. So the only difference, says Rav Noach Weinberg, between loving someone and hating someone is how you view their actions, how you understand what's motivating them. Then maybe loving someone is really just seeing their actions in a positive light. If hating someone is seeing them acting poorly, then loving someone is seeing them acting positively. And so this guy who sees the Soto Bikakula, and he says, oh, that's so terrible, that's so awful, really, this person seemingly needs to increase in his love for his fellow Jew. He needs to say, oh, that's so beautiful. Not, Rabbi Ari Khan says he doesn't like to get flowers for his wife. Because if someone's, you know, see a man going through the streets with a nice big bouquet of flowers, one of two reactions come. Maybe it's, oh, that's so beautiful, it's so nice that he's bringing flowers to his wife. But some people, maybe people who have been around the block a little bit, they tend to ask, what did he do wrong? And so he doesn't like getting flowers for his wife. He thinks it makes him look bad. And so this nazir, this stranger, this czar, who's so disconnected from the Jewish people, he's growing out his hair, or she's growing out her hair, because they can't see the sota process in a positive light. They're just so disconnected. And that brings us to our second point. What's motivating the drinking? How come I'm not allowed to drink if I'm a nazir? So we have the Rashi approach that, you know, you want to stay away from illicit relations, and you don't want to make any big mistakes. But what if there's more to it? What if we can appreciate this concept of drinking in the context of the person being distant from his fellow Jew or from her fellow Jewess, or also Jew? Well, let's think about it. When do people drink? I mean, these days, maybe people drink all the time because they're home anyway. But generally, when are people drinking? What's motivating someone to drink? When they're celebrating. When something good's happening. You go to someone's simcha, people are going to drink. And so there's like a debate in the world of weddings. I had this debate myself. I was against the drinking, and I think I still am, but I was overruled. At a wedding, do you want to have an open bar? Do you want to have lots of drinking? Or do you want it to, you know, not be a place of drunken silliness? Admittedly, some of my own editorial ideas might be coming out in this regard. And one of the arguments to be made for having drinking is that someone will say, well, you know, we want the groom's friends, we want the people celebrating to be labedik, to get really into it. You know, you drink a little bit, you sort of drop your inhibitions a little bit, and you can really enjoy, you can make the party awesome. So the person is drinking in order to lower their defenses, to lower the barriers around them. The question I always wonder is, if the groom's friends, the bride's friends, really cared about their friend, they would be so excited that the bride, the groom, found their Eitzah Kenegdo. I'm so glad that my friend found his or her spouse. Why do I have to drink? Why do I need to be consuming alcohol to loosen my inhibitions if I'm so genuinely happy for my friend. So it causes me to wonder, maybe the need to drink is a little bit suspect, and I think it can actually illuminate to us something important. If you need to drink wine in order to feel closer to someone, maybe you're not really so close. And maybe you used to think that you were close because of the wine drinking. So we tell the Nazir, for a month, no wine, no drinking. You feel so close to everyone, whether it's in the bar or the party or the Kiddush, and you were giving people hugs. But maybe that's because there's been barriers up that drop because of the substances that are in your body, but not necessarily because you genuinely have that close connection. Maybe you should stop drinking for a month and develop a real close connection with the people around you, and you won't need to drink anymore. And I think it's ironic that, you know, I think people just sort of pop in and pop out whenever they see what's going on. Likely they see what's going on and they get bored. But as we're talking about drinking, the numbers keep going up. How exciting. And so, admittedly, I'm not so into drinking and that's coming out, and that's totally fine. It doesn't bother me. But I think the reason why the Nazir stops drinking, according to this Rav Judah Michel approach, that the person's feeling disconnected, is you got to stop drinking, because if you think that you're close to someone only because you're drinking, then we got to stop it to reveal that you're actually not that close. And that leads us to our third symptom, the third law that exists within the context of being a Nazir is that of Tumat Meat. You're not allowed to come in contact with a dead body. So let's think realistically. How does that manifest? What does it mean that you can't come in contact with a dead body? So admittedly, the Nazir is not allowed to be a mortician. Okay, I don't know if that's like such a loss for most Nazirim. Like, I don't know if most people, are they really pining to be morticians? It's a wonderful job and it's a respectable job, but like, I don't think that most people grow up saying, I really want to work in the morgue. I really want to come in contact with dead bodies. And so what is motivating this Nazir? Why does the Nazir need to do it? I can tell you that I'm a Kohen. I'm a priest, and that means that I am not allowed to come in contact with dead bodies, but not just contact. I'm not allowed to be in the same airspace or the same area or the same building. I have to stay far away from dead bodies. And so, on the one hand, it means I can't be part of the Kavur Kedisha, which actually, on a personal level, makes me a little bit sad, because I think that the ability to be part of the Kavur Kedisha, the people that like take care of the body before it's being buried, I think that's incredible, and I would love to be able to do that. Such a tremendous chesed. But practically, what does it mean that I'm a Kohen? It means that I can't go to funerals to the same extent as everyone else. I can't be there for someone, you know, standing next to the grave of their parent. And same thing with the Nazir. The Nazir can't do it. And it's very hard for me. It's very hard for me to not be able to go to friends' funerals and to be there, you know, as they're literally burying their parent. Maybe I can go to the service and or stand in the back or outside. It's not the same connection, though. So why don't we let the Nazir go to funerals? Well, let's imagine. Unfortunately, I experienced lots of funerals in the past year and a half, 2 years. And when you walk into the funeral home and you see that the room is packed, it's heartwarming. It's really nice. Look at how many people care about me, care about my family, care about my loved one who passed away. But if you walk into the room and none of the people there really wanted to be there, all the people there are there because the funeral parlor wants to bring people in, make themselves look good, and so they have hired actors just sitting there, you know, people who are set to do the crying, and people set to do the giggling with the bad jokes. They've got all of them set up so people like going to their funeral home. That'd be terrible. If someone, you know, and instead of having to do community service by cleaning up garbage, someone's community service was just sitting in a funeral parlor waiting for funerals to happen, am I going to feel good if that person's at my funeral, at my family's funeral? Is that going to make me feel good? No, that person has no connection between me, to my loved one, to this experience. So the fact that you're a stranger here is not helping me. The Nazir, the Tzar, the stranger, can't go to funerals because you're not going to help the person in the funeral. You're not going to make the person mourning feel any better because you have no personal connection. Now, if someone's going to come in and they're going to try and make a personal connection and try and connect, even though they didn't know the person who died or the family member, that can be beautiful. But in all likelihood, this person who's disconnected, who's got this barrier, they're not going to do a good job. It's not going to go well. And so we say, don't even bother. I don't want you at my funeral. Stay far, far away. You're no good to me. You're so disconnected from the Jewish people that it's better that you not be around at all. And so we've got three things. We've got the hair that grows out, as Rav Hirsch explained, because the hair is representing the disconnection between me and the outside world, to the Jewish people, to my people around me. I have a blockade. And the drinking is because maybe there's a blockade that I'm ignoring, because anytime I drink, that blockade falls. And the dead bodies, the avoiding of funerals, is because I'm so disconnected, I can't make a funeral any better. I'm not going to help in the context of a funeral. And so this Nazir is so disconnected, and these three things happen. And at the end of a month of Nazirus, the person shaves off their hair and their beard. They shave off everything. And now the hair is gone. That blockade is gone. And they can once again partake of grapes and grape juice and wine. And they can go to Simchas. And maybe they're going to drink, but they're not going to drink because they feel they need to drink, but because they're so genuinely connected, because that blockade that was set up is no longer there. And they'll go to funerals, a time that have such great need, where people need to connect. And they're able to do that properly because they've been a Nazir for a month. But I was thinking about this. Sfirat HaOmer just ended. Thank God I've got a relatively nice haircut. You know, I think I'm getting pretty good at the at-home haircut thing. And during Sfirah, you know, we don't shave, we don't cut our hair for 33 days. You know, beginning and whatever, maybe it's 50 days. A Stam Nazirus, basic person, someone who says, you know, I'm not personally saying it, you know, Blin Ender, but someone who says, I want to be a Nazir, that person's a Nazir for 30 days, for 1 month. Is it such a big deal to not cut your hair for 30 days? When was the last time that you cut your hair? Maybe it was a few days ago or last week because of Shuas, but to go a month, when I don't cut my hair during Sfirat HaOmer, it's not such a big deal. So if I'm like a little bit of a chacham and I see this sota situation, I decide to become a nazir, I'll go to the barber shop and then say, oh, I want to be a nazir. And after a month, I'll need a haircut. But it's not such a big deal. I'm not putting myself out to such an extent by not cutting my hair for a month. Now, so maybe the shaving is a little bit harder, but think about it. If you live in ancient Israel, everybody had a beard anyway. It's not so hard. And I can just tell you based on my high school experience that there are girls who you know, are not getting their hair cut for like half a year even. You know, girls who I went to Krishna with used to, you know, grow their hair long, 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 long because it just wasn't worth cutting it. So what's the point of having the Nazir grow out his or her hair for a month? That's not a big deal at all. And yet we seem to make it such a big deal. Oh, the Nazir's not cutting their hair. Okay, if you're Shimshon and you don't cut your hair for your whole life and it's the source of your strength, fine. But for general people, why is not cutting your hair for a month a big deal? So I think, if I could so suggest, that the big deal is not that the Nazir grows his or her hair for a month, but it's that at the end of that month of recognizing a separation, of being separate, of acknowledging and realizing that I'm disconnected from the people around me, the person cuts all their hair off. At the end of Sfira, we cut our hair off. And when a Metzora, the person who spoke Lashon Hara and was disconnected from the Jewish people as well, the Metzora shaves all their hair off. When the Kohanim are being inaugurated to serve in the temple, Moshe cuts all their hair off. Korach is Midashon Kireach. Korach was bald. Why was Korach bald? Because Moshe shaved off all his head, and that actually led to a whole fight between Korach and his wife, and that's for a few parashiot from now. But when the Kohanim would cut their hair off, when the Metzor would cut their hair off, it's because these people are trying to connect. The Kohanim are leading the Jewish people, need to be connected to the Jewish people. The Metzor is trying to reconnect to the Jewish people, and the Nazir, who's been disconnected, is now connecting. I'm going to cut my hair off so that I can now connect with people. I'm going to connect again. This is not this separation that I've experienced, that I've been feeling, that I now understand after a month of Nazirus. It's now gone. I'm getting rid of it. So to wrap up, we'll just review. There are three laws when it comes to Nazir: not cutting hair or cutting the hair, as we said, at the end of the process, staying away from wine, and staying away from dead bodies. Rav Judah said that what's motivating the Nazir to become a Nazir? Not because the person sees the sota in her degradation, and that's so terrible that she ended up almost cheating on her spouse, and so I don't want to do that, and so I'm going to stop drinking. But that you're so disconnected from the Jewish people that you can't appreciate that there's something beautiful happening in this, in the case of the Isha Sota, that the Isha Sota is going through such a laborious and difficult and challenging process in order to become mutter to her husband once again. That's wonderful. And if you're so disconnected, then you need to figure out a way to reconnect. We're going to let you become attuned to the disconnection. Based on the way Rav Hirsch explained that the hair separates you, that the way we explained that the wine might have given you a false sense of connection, that's not really there. Your inability to be with people at their time of need at a funeral because you're so far apart, all of that after a month hopefully goes away when the Nazir cuts off his or her hair, when there's a renewal of connection. The lesson from the Nazir, learning from the Isha Sota, is that desire for us to be personally connected to the Jewish people. It's been a pleasure learning with you today. Thank you so much for joining me. And I look forward to learning with you again in the near future. Bye-bye.